From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Professor Sharon Davies has worked for firms in Washington, D.C. and New York City, as well as serving for 5 years as an assistant United States attorney in New York before joining the faculty at The Ohio State University in 1995. Her primary research focus is the area of criminal law and procedure. She is a co-author of a leading treatise on healthcare fraud, Medicare, and Medicaid fraud and abuse, a senior faculty fellowship from The Ohio State University's Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity supported her research for her recently released book, Rising Road, A True Tale of Love, Race, and Religion in America. Welcome, Professor Davies, to Writer's Talk.
Thank you, Doug. It's nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the criminal case on which your book is based. It's the murder of a Catholic priest, James Coyle, by a Methodist minister who was also the father of a woman for whom Father Coyle had performed a marriage ceremony earlier that day or a few days before that, right?
Right, right. Rising Road tells a true story that happened back in Birmingham in 1921. And the victim, as you say, was a Catholic priest. In fact, the presiding priest of the largest Catholic congregation in Alabama at that time, Father James Coyle. And on the day that this murder took place, Reverend Edwin Stevenson, who was an ordained Methodist minister, learned that his 18-year-old daughter, Ruth Stevenson, had been married to a Catholic man who was a migrant from Puerto Rico. He was furious when he learned that news, and he took a gun to the home of the priest, where the priest was sitting out on the porch, and he shot him and killed him. Mm-hmm. And so Rising Road talks about that crime and what it was that caused that kind of fury in an ordained Methodist minister that would impel him to take that kind of action. And then it follows the shooting through the outcome of the trial of the minister some months later.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the buildup to the shooting and some of the amazing things that they had gone through. They had attempted to have their daughter committed, right? And there were people ready to do it without even talking to her, or doctors ready to commit her without even examining her, based on her father describing, I guess, the fact that she was going to marry outside of the religion and marry somebody outside of the race. So what led you to be interested in this? You write in the beginning that this is a little known chapter. It's disappeared from the annals of history. How did you get interested in it?
It was really by accident that I got interested in it because I was working on some research for a law review article that I thought I was going to be writing. And so when I was researching that, I just happened to trip over a reference to a trial that happened back in 1921 in Birmingham, where at the center of a homicide trial, there was this issue about a young 18-year-old girl being married to a Catholic Puerto Rican. And so I thought, well, that was interesting because I was looking at the way that law had been used in the past to police marriage partners on the color line, and in particular, the way that the criminal law had been used. And so I thought, oh, you know, that's probably going to be a good example of the kind of intense emotion that motivated the passage of what we refer to as anti-miscegenation laws, laws that prohibited blacks from marrying whites primarily, although other races were involved as well in the anti-miscegenation laws. And so I went to look for the trial transcript of that case in Birmingham, and as soon as I found it, I was completely captivated by what had happened there and was incredibly surprised at the level of anti-Catholicism that existed, not just in Birmingham, but around the country at that time that I started to see as I began to research that story and quickly decided to write a book about the story instead of that article that I had been planning to write.
Okay. Now, I'm curious about the movement between writing for a historical document versus writing a legal document. You said you were working on a journal article So that's a very different genre, I imagine.
Yeah.
And I noticed on the back cover you have a comment from Kevin Boyle, who's been a guest on this story on this show before. And his book is also a narrative of history in a way that yours is. It covers some of the same sort of legal historical grounds. And I'm curious about your reaction about that. You go, when you're doing your research, that's a historical research, but it's also legal. How do you negotiate those two, to me, quite different sorts of fields?
Right. At first, I have to tell you that that was one of the big challenges to writing this book for me, because, as you say, this kind of writing is actually pretty unusual for a law professor to do. It would be much more typical for someone who is in a history department like Professor Kevin Boyle. When I first began to work on the book, that was a little bit intimidating to me, even the answering the question to myself, will I actually be able to write this way? Because law professors generally write law journal articles that are mostly addressed to other law professors, maybe some members of the bar, an occasional judge or two, but for the most part, a relatively narrow audience. This kind of writing is completely different. It is written in the narrative, and it is intentionally written to appeal to a broad reading audience. Because of the power of the story itself, I decided that if I wrote it more narrowly to an academic audience or about it to an academic audience, I really would be doing a disservice to the story itself. It is powerful, compelling enough, I think, for it to appeal to and educate more readers about what happened, what we were most afraid of back in 1921.
You know, Kevin Boyle described his book as the book you write after tenure, the book that you're really interested in. I'm curious about your take on academic writing, whether that's a trend of a broadening of the audience, where it's not just a tome about, you know, 5 days in the Roman Empire or something that's, you know, excessively researched, but it goes to a much larger area of interest, because this is a book that I think that you would also be shelving at Barnes & Noble or something along those lines. It's not something that's intended just for an academic, as you said, audience. Is that a increasing trend, do you think, or just there have always been people that were writing in that area and you're joining that small group, or what's your take on that?
I think it might actually be an overstatement to say just yet that it is a trend.
Okay.
I hope it becomes a trend, because as Kevin believes, I think, and I do as well, this kind of writing can reach more people and pull more people into our history, right? To expose them to things that we've forgotten even happened in the United States. And so if you can do that through writing, well, what an incredibly great thing that would be for an academic, a teacher, someone devoted to education. So it's a little curious in some ways that academics aren't doing this kind of writing. But as you say, this is probably the kind of piece that you would write after tenure. It matters to me that I've been on the faculty at Ohio State for 15 years now. I'm well past the tenure stage. And I don't think I would necessarily in today's academic environment, advise someone pre-tenured to write this, because it's a little risky. But having said that, I don't think anybody could read this story and not consider it to be a contribution to our understanding of American and legal history. So even though it reads like a novel, it is completely true, and so has some real educational value, I think, for many readers.
When you talk about writing it as a novel, were there things that you did to become as familiar with novel writing? Are you a big novel reader? How did you do it? Because you've got one of your big characters dies pretty soon into it, and not giving a lot away, but we have said it's about a murder. So, you know, you've got to then say, all right, what do we do with this character who's already dead? How do we treat that? How do we treat the surroundings? What were your touchstones for creating a novelistic or way of leading people through a story?
Yeah. Well, I read more nonfiction than fiction. I do allow myself some time for reading fiction
It sounds very guilty that you allow yourself some sort of
fiction. Well, you know, it's true for all of us. We have a certain amount of time as readers, and so we have to make judgment calls about it. And so I often reach first for nonfiction, but I do have some favorites every year in the fiction category. But I will say for writing this, what I did was I kept within arm's reach, literally on my desk, books like Kevin Boyle's Arc of Justice or Truman Capote's In Cold Blood or Tim Egan's The Worst Hard Times, Eric Larson's Devil in the White City. All of those, as you know, Doug, were books that are nonfiction, but they're written in the narrative. And so these were all authors either coming out of history departments or with journalism backgrounds who really knew how to write, who also were telling a story that was true and did it in a magical enough, compelling, engaging enough way that they served as my examples for whenever I got stuck, whenever I had a problem of how do I say this in an engaging way, in a non-academic, you might say, way, style.
And engaging equals non-academic, you know, in that formulation.
I hate to say that, but academics can write in an esoteric way that puts off the average reader. And in fact, when before I got my book contract, I talked to some book publishers, and there was a certain amount of skepticism before I wrote the first chapters about whether an academic could really write about this story in a way that engaged the average reader. I had to actually get over that hurdle with them before I could even get a book contract.
You submitted chapters to get over that hurdle to prove that it was going to be engaging?
And did you,
what kind of feedback did they give you? Was it all, okay, this is good? Or were there times when they said, here's what we want you to change to be more engaging, less academic?
Well, actually, once I got my book contract after I had written the first four chapters of this book, so I had a fair sample of how it was that I was intending to write about this story. And once they read that, it was smooth sailing because they could see that I actually was able to do it. But there was that skepticism at first.
Well, let's take a moment, and you've got a excerpt that you're going to read, and maybe you can set that up for us and then give us some of the story.
Yeah. Okay, so the part that I want to read is actually what happened on the day that Ruth Stevenson and Pedro Guzman got married. It was August 11th, 1921, and it was the middle of the day. They slipped away from their jobs because Ruth and Pedro knew that Ruth's father and mother were going to object to their marriage.
One might say, given what happened afterwards.
That's right. And so they slipped away in the middle of the day. And so this part is about what happened to them. Ruth and Pedro had agreed to make August 11th, 1921 look like a normal work day. They had agreed to meet at noon with a plan to take the streetcar to Bessemer, where they would apply for their license to avoid running into Ruth's father at the courthouse in Birmingham. But when the time came for Ruth to meet Pedro that day, and she moved toward the front door of the department store where she worked, one of her uncles was just walking in. She was sure she would be caught, she said later, but by some act of heaven, the man failed to see her, and Ruth willed her feet to keep moving until she reached the spot outside where Pedro was waiting. In Bessemer, they were nearly foiled again. After they had obtained their license from the probate judge, they walked the few blocks to the local Catholic church, St. Aloysius, and asked to speak with Father Callahan, its presiding priest. But the priest was out. He would not be back in time to perform their rites, they were told. How strange, the things that can unravel a plan. The possibility that Father Callahan might be away had obviously not occurred to them. After formulating a secret meeting place, dodging Ruth's relative, sidestepping the place her father was most likely to be, and obtaining the state's official permission to wed, the last critical ingredient needed to accomplish their plan, a priest, was missing. It could not have been easy for the couple to decide to return to Birmingham. The Bessemer marriage license authorized any official pastor in the state to marry them. So if they could make it to St. Paul's unseen, they could ask Father Coyle for his help. But the rectory was terrifyingly close to the courthouse where Ruth's father conducted marriages in the hallways. If Stevenson happened to step outside as they were approaching the rectory, all would be lost. Worse, had Ruth and Pedro known the full truth, that Edwin Stevenson was already on the lookout for his daughter, that he had been canvassing the streets all afternoon, that he and Mary Stevenson had alerted the police there and a private detective as well, all of whom were making efforts to find the girl, the prospect of returning to the city would likely have been unthinkable. But the couple labored under that great advantage of ignorance, and being unaware of the determined multiplicity of efforts already underway in the city to discover her, Ruth and Pedro resolved to double back to Birmingham to be married at St. Paul's. And somehow, they managed it. When the streetcar arrived back in the city, Pedro and Ruth stepped off it and moved toward the towering twin steeples that guarded the entrance of St. Paul's. The bustle of the downtown streets must have conferred some soothing, frenetic cover, helping them pass undetected, even across Third Avenue and straight up the walkway to the rectory door. But there, luck failed them again. Father Coyle was out, Father Brady told them. He was visiting with Father Malone at the rebuilt St. Catherine's Church in nearby Pratt City. And because Ruth and Pedro had posted no bans at St. Paul's, announcing their plans to marry in advance, by church rule, only its presiding priest, Father Coyle, possessed the authority to take their vows. It might have seemed that heaven itself was testing their firmness. Later, no doubt, with the maddening benefit of hindsight, Father Brady must have wished that he had just sent the twosome away. But at that moment, as he looked at the couple standing on the threshold of the rectory, no doubt he read the desperation on their faces. The urge to assist them must have been strong. He could call St. Catherine's to see if Father Coyle could be reached, Father Brady offered. Ruth and Pedro said they would wait.
This is WCRS, Columbus's only community radio station, and you're listening to The Ohio State University's Writer's Talk, produced by the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing. My guest is Sharon Davies, professor of law at Ohio State, and she was just reading from her recent book, Rising Road, A True Tale of Love, Race, and Religion in America. If you'd like to hear more writers like Professor Davies, visit facebook.com/writerstalk. And for a different kind of author, attend the April 1st reading by Christopher Moore at the Thurber House. More information is available on that visit at www.thurberhouse.org. Now, back to our discussion with Professor Davies.
And then it goes from there.
Yeah.
So tell me about researching the book. Has the internet made easier your access to, I'm assuming, primary and secondary sources, but has it simply increased the speed, or has it made it more factual and accurate, do you think? What, when you were researching this book, was your use of the internet and the sorts of databases and things like that? You've got a lot of pictures in here, and I'm wondering if that's partially where they came from or how that occurred.
Actually not, because this story is as old as it is, occurring in 1921. The research for this book really took me down to Birmingham and Alabama more times than I ever imagined I would be in that fine state. And because the documents that I needed to discover to write about this story were mostly in archives in Birmingham Public Library and other libraries in the state of Alabama. Because of the age of the story, much of the information about what happened there actually isn't accessible. You have to really actually go into the bowels of these old libraries.
They're always described as the bowels. Yeah. Never, you know, another body part into the heart of the library. You're going into the bowels of them. Okay.
Right. And it's a little bit of an isolating process to do this kind of research. For me, it was absolutely fascinating. I love history. And this really challenged me in a way that doing the research for most of the law journal articles that I write really just doesn't do. Because for those, the internet, electronic databases are really used very heavily by legal scholars. But this, I had to find the trial transcript. I had to find the grand jury record. I had to find old newspaper accounts of what happened in Birmingham and then around the country as the nation watched what was happening in Birmingham after the shooting and through the course of the trial. So all of those are available, but sometimes on microfilm instead of electronic databases that are so prevalent today. And so that really required a different kind of research than what I often do.
I'm imagining there was no ability to do primary research with anyone who was there. Everybody is long dead. Even the children may be dead. So that must be a sort of a block for somebody who's, I mean, in legal circles, you can go generally like LexisNexis databases, look things up. But a lot of legal, as I sort of vaguely understand it from not being involved in it, it's a fast moving kind of thing. You're looking at precedents that are 10, 15 years old or so. Not the case here. And you've got to go down into the bowels and find all this stuff. What do you do with it then? Are there the legal ability to just photocopy everything and then it's in your office in dusty boxes that you got to keep around for a long time?
Well, a lot of that is really true. One thing I will say about interviewing live people, though, is that I did do that actually at the beginning of the process a little bit. As you say, all of the people who are centrally involved in this case are no longer alive. But I was able to interview some women in their late 80s, their 90s, who were still living in Birmingham when I began the research here, and who were young Catholic children at the time that this occurred. And they could tell us stories about what it was like to be Catholic children when the men in the Ku Klux Klan were roaming the streets of Birmingham and targeting Catholics and Jews and foreigners along with blacks. So that's a big part of this story, is that Edwin Stevenson was a Klansman. And at that time, it wasn't particularly surprising for a member of the clergy, the Protestant clergy, to be a Klansman. It wasn't a surprise for lawyers in the case to be Klansmen, or the judges in the region, or doctors. Scholars of the Klan during this period of time, this is the second Klan of the 1920s, tell us that the Klan at this time was enormously successful in rebranding itself as a patriotic organization filled with men who were defending traditional American values, the American flag, the Constitution of the United States. And so as a result of its rebranding, was able to attract the best men in town, literally. And so that's a part of this story. And the Catholic ladies that I had an opportunity to interview told me about what it was like to be growing up at that time when the Klan was focused on them and their religion. him. But at the same time, a lot of the research really was piecing together the story, and it was a great fortune to me that this happened in 1921 because this was before the proliferation of commercial radio in the country, before TV, mm-hmm. and at a time when cities the size of Birmingham, Alabama, it wasn't unusual for them to have 2-3 major newspapers, some issues in the morning, some in the afternoon, because that's where Americans got their news. Mm-hmm. And so that turned out to be a great boon for me, because this was literally the biggest story in Alabama, but it was also a national story. The New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, all of these papers across the country were following what was happening in Birmingham from the moment that it happened through the end of the trial. And that left behind an enormously rich record of how people were responding to it, what happened, why it happened. And so even though I didn't have the opportunity to interview the people who were the central parties in the case, I was able to recover a lot that told me what happened.
Right. Now, without giving away the ending, which we don't do, so you'll have to read the book. What I'm curious about, was there legal precedent set by the case? Can you talk about that without giving away what actually happens at the trial? Because it's interesting that after the shooting, the shooter walks calmly, slowly, to the courthouse and turns himself in, where he had been performing marriages, I suppose, earlier that day, then walks in, surrenders the gun to two policemen who have their guns trained on him, and says, I'm here to surrender, I did it, blah, blah, blah. So, that then unfolds in a very different way. But did it affect law?
Well, I'll say this. I can say this without, I think, ruining the ending of the story at all. After the minister turned himself in that day, almost immediately, the Ku Klux Klan began to mobilize support for him, mm-hmm. and in fact was the group that raised the funds for his defense. And they hired his lawyer, his leading attorney, who was Hugo Black, at the time, this was Hugo Black before he was Hugo Black, the mm-hmm. Hugo Black we know. Hugo Black went on to become a justice of the United States Supreme Court later on in his life. But this was Hugo Black when he was a young man making a name for himself in Birmingham, Alabama. And so part of the story about the trial and the later chapters of the book talk about the decisions that young Hugo Black made on behalf of his client, this Methodist minister, Edwin Stevenson, and what he thought was appropriate to do in 1921, which if you had followed him throughout his career and his later involvement in incredibly important decisions to the country when he was a Supreme Court justice, you would see the movement not only of a man and a legal thinker, but the movement of a nation itself.
Well, that is a great way to leave that, so that they have to buy the book, have to read the book, get at the library. I want to thank you, Professor Sharon Davies from the Ohio State University College of Law, for coming to talk to us today on Writer's Talk. Again, the book is Rising Road.
For more great authors like Professor Davies or Kevin Boyle, who we mentioned during this interview, visit facebook.com/writerstalk. Don't forget to check out Christopher Moore on April 1st at the Thurber House by surfing to thurberhouse.org. And speaking of Thurber House, join us next time for Thurber House author Carol Goodman, author of Arcadia Falls. Let's listen in to a little bit of that interview.
But you know when you sit down, you started off writing short stories,
mm-hmm.
And now you're doing novels. You know when you do it that it's going to be a novel. Do you ever have times like, you know what, this isn't the novel that I thought it was going to be. This is a long short story.
I wish that I still wrote short stories, but the fact is I don't. Since I really have been writing novels since Lake of Dead Languages was published, which was about 10 years ago, I've had a contract to write the next novel. And so I have written the next novel. And I do think that even when I was a short story writer, that I was always more a novelist, sort of struggling within the framework of a story that my imagination created stories that were longer than a short story format. I wish, though, that I, if I had more time, I would be nice to write short stories in between each novel.
Why? Why do you wish that?
Because I think you can develop, you can take more risks, and you can develop yourself as a writer using other forms. I know that when I went back to writing short stories and poetry before I wrote Lake of Dead Languages, I know it improved myself as a writer.
That's next time on Writer's Talk, Monday at 7 p.m. on WCRS. Until then, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.